This recording is starting on time, thanks to a student who had the good sense to remind me to turn the silly thing on, something that would never have occurred to me otherwise. So we're talking about the energy cooperative problem, which we were talking just beginning on at the end of last class, and the basic issue here is that there are two suggested changes in how they do the accounting. One of them is going into a LIFO system instead of FIFO, and the other is that they think that they should write off about half the book value of the computer equipment. And the problem, the potential problem you're supposed to be looking at, which is a kind of problem that I think can occur in the real world, is that the bank loan has some conditions. Perfectly reasonable. The bank doesn't want to lend you money and then have you spend all the money so you can't pay them back. And the bank loan requires that your annual return on assets must stay at or above 5%, and that your ratio of liabilities to surplus must stay at or below 200%. All right, so they're worried about situations in which you might be unable to repay the loan. And so the question is, will either of the suggested accounting changes affect either of those numbers? If they switch from FIFO to LIFO, will that change either of the numbers? And if they write off the computers, will that change it? Here are the numbers for the cooperative. Looking at those numbers, what is going to change if they switch how they account for their oil? All right, I keep forgetting which one. So if they go in to a last in, first out, oil prices have been rising. So last in, first out will mean that the oil they sell will have a higher book value than under FIFO, which is what they were using. So if the So if they switch to valuing for accounting purposes the oil they sell at a higher price, what will that do to either of the relevant things? To either the ratio, sorry, I'm slow today, let me go back a moment. The two things that they have to worry about are return on assets and liability to surplus ratio. Let me write that up because you might forget them as well.
Return on assets, ROA, and liabilities over surplus. So liabilities over surplus has to stay less than or equal to 200%. Return on assets has to stay greater than or equal to 5%. So the first question is asked, what are those names before we, numbers before we make the changes? Because obviously, if we've got if return on assets is 50%, then we'd have to make a pretty big change to get up below 5, so we don't have to worry about it. So let's start on that. What is net income? Looking at what's up on the board.
Do I need to take this thing in the way?
So what's net income? Looking at the income statement.
What's net income? All right, net income is $31,000. And what are assets? Return on assets is income over assets. What?
So $300,000.
Return on assets is $300,000. So about what is the
ratio is the return on assets.
10%?
What? A little over 10%.
Right.
A little over 10%. Not quite 11, but it's around 10.3% roughly, I think, if you work that out. Yeah, about 10.3%. So it looks as though we're pretty safe as far as, you know, if we do something that really cuts it, you have to worry, but at least you're not close. How about liabilities over surplus? What are our liabilities? And what is our surplus? Surplus, alias equity, what?
100,000.
What is that ratio? So it looks as though we're just on the edge, right? We're still not in default,
but if that number gets any worse, we're in default. So now what happens if we decide to go to a LIFO system? How does that affect our net income? Does it change the revenue side of the income calculation?
Expense.
Change the expense side. In what direction?
I don't remember
the hypo was the prices are going up. Fuel prices are going up. That's right.
So the result is that if we go to LIFO, expenses go up, so net income does what? What?
Goes
down. Net income is going to go down. And we don't have enough information to know by how much it's going to go down. Then anything going to happen to our assets if we do it that way? What happens to our assets at the end of the year if we're doing it on a LIFO basis and prices are rising?
Your assets will go down.
That's right. So the assets are also going to go down. And we don't know the numbers. On the other hand, if you think about it, the assets go down with this change by the same amount of dollars as the income goes down. Isn't that right? Because in each case, what's happening is that for accounting purposes, the oil you've lost is $10,000 more. So that's $10,000 less in your assets and $10,000 greater in your costs. So since assets is a larger number than net income, the same number of dollars is a smaller proportion. Therefore, the net effect is going to be that the ratio goes down. That this number is proportionally going down more than that one. We don't know for sure, but given that we currently have net income over assets of more than twice what's required, unless the effect is very large, we're probably safe. Right? We don't know for sure. How about liabilities over surplus? When we go to LIFO, what does LIFO do to our liabilities? Anything?
Nothing.
Zip. Liabilities are unaffected. What does it do to our surplus?
Increases.
What does it do to our surplus?
Decreases.
Our assets go down because we've now officially sold off more expensive oil. For accounting purposes, the oil left in our tanks is cheap oil rather than expensive oil, so therefore lower value, so therefore our liabilities go down. And if our liabilities go down, sorry, our assets go down, our surplus goes down. If surplus goes down and liabilities stay the same, what happens to the ratio of liabilities over surplus? Goes up. So liabilities over surplus goes up, and that means it's now more than 200%. And the bank calls it a loan. People follow the logic of that one?
Now, I'm being a little hasty, of course, because maybe we can talk to the bank before we change our accounting system, because all that's happened, not that the company's any worse off than before, all that's happened is we've changed our accounts. But at least if we just do this and nothing else changes, then on paper we're in violation of our loan terms. All right? So, going through it here on the screen, the return on assets is now 10%. The liability to surplus ratio is exactly at 200 at our 200%, so anymore and we're in default. LIFO raises the accounting cost of the fuel sold. Next year's income is less, lowering the return on assets. Unless the effect is big, no problem. Assets will also be lower since the book value of the remaining oil is lower because we've sold off officially the expensive oil, which raises the return on assets and partly compensates. But lower assets means lower surplus, means higher ratio of liabilities to surplus, which is over 200%, so we're in default. So that answers first question, which is that changing to a LIFO accounting will put us in violation of our loan agreements unless we do something about the loan agreement. Or something else changes we don't know about. Questions? No. How about the computers? If we write off the computers, that means that the inventory has now $20,000 less, right? If the inventory is $20,000 less, then our surplus is $20,000 less, and our income is $20,000 less, because we've now got an expense. One of the things that goes before you get into that net income is going to be losses, in this case the write-off on the appreciation, if you want to call it that, on the computers. So if we drop our income from 31,000 to 11,000, even though we started with a 2-to-1 advantage, we're now dropping it by about 2/3, so we now are below our 5% limit, so we're now in default. All right? People follow that, the argument, or not? Any problem? Is it all clear? I didn't do it on the board, but the basic argument is that you are taking a loss of $20,000. That's not a very large amount relative to your liabilities and your assets, but it's a quite a large amount relative to your income, and it's the ratio of income to assets that's one of the triggers for the loan agreement. So that suggests that in each case, if you're going to do it, you ought first to talk to the bank, and you either say to the bank, look, we're thinking of making this accounting change, it'll push us over the limit in these ways, we'd like to get your advance agreement that you will modify the terms of the loan to let us do that. Or alternatively, you say, we're going to find another lender, borrow money, pay off this loan, and the other lender will negotiate better terms. All clear? All right. Let's go to Apex. And this, I thought, was the most fun one, actually. I don't know how many of you actually tried working it through, but you should have, because it's a nice little detective problem as to what's exactly going on with this firm. And the relevant point is that your client is thinking of taking a job as an executive with Apex, and he would like your opinion as to whether this is a good career move. And what he's done is to hand you their financial statements and ask you read those statements and tell me if it looks as though this is a prosperous firm which will make my future, or if they're about to end up on the front page of the New York Times and in bankruptcy court and in jail and or anywhere in between those. Where do we think it's going? And here are the balance sheets. And if you look at those balance sheets, looking at those sheets, what things strike you? Okay. Notice that the balance sheets 99, 2000, and 2001, and we're with that 2001 is the latest one. This is a little bit out of date. Total assets seem to be pretty stable. They're about what they were last year, better than the year before. Net incomes going up. That looks pretty good.
The unbilled accounts receivable.
Unbilled accounts receivable didn't exist for the previous 2 years, and they're now more than $2 million. Yeah, that looks like something you might wonder about. From the standpoint of the effect on the balance sheet, what is the effect of that of those unbilled accounts receivable. What are they doing?
Well, they're in there as an asset, but we have no idea how certain that is an asset or why it was unbilled.
Putting it differently, that number, if you took that number out, assets would have dropped catastrophically from the previous year. So if they're bogus, and we don't know if they're bogus yet, but they're at least a little suspicious, then they're in there to make the assets look much better than they are. Okay. Anything else you notice?
Extraordinary gain from sale of land.
Yeah, extraordinary gain from sale of land. Now, extraordinary gain from sale of land doesn't do a whole lot about the assets, but it does have some interesting effects. We don't know how much that land was on the books for. We know that the total value of plant, land, and equipment has gone down, but whether that's because the land was on the books for its real value or much less, we don't know, because other things are recently happening. What else do you notice looking at that balance sheet? What else has changed quite strikingly?
Cash
is one thing, right? $750,000, $565,000,
$112,000.
And notice that they got $450,000 of cash when they sold that land. And even with that, cash is way, way down. What else has changed strikingly?
Your regular accounts receivable.
Regular accounts receivable has also gone up quite a lot. Right? Now, it's not as spectacular, but it's 50% up from last year. It makes you wonder, maybe they're just doing a bad job of collecting their debts, or maybe not. And the inventory's vanished. Right? The inventory has dropped from about $1.5 million the previous 2 years to $250,000. So the inventory is about a sixth what it's been running. How would you sum up that balance sheet? In just a few brief words, what's there lots of and what's there little of?
A lot of money, not a lot of money.
What do inventory and cash have in common?
Disappear.
What?
Disappear.
They have in common the fact you can count the damn things. Right. That they have well-defined values, pretty well-defined values. Inventory is perfectly. Whereas unbilled accounts receivable and accounts receivable, it is very hard for us to know from the outside what they really represent. Take a look at the income statement, and the income statement looks quite good, but notice that the $400,000 wasn't the value of the land, it was the gain from the value of the land, my mistake. So we do know that pushed income up by $450,000, and presumably pushed assets up by that, which wouldn't have been a huge amount, but would have been a noticeable amount on that statement. So net income doesn't look so good if you don't count that $450,000, then it's a noticeable drop from the previous year. I'm not showing the year before that because of... And in addition, of course, since we don't really know what's going on with the unbilled accounts receivable, whatever that means, we don't really know if those sales revenues, which will include unbilled accounts receivable, really are real or not. Anything else that seems to have changed by a surprising amount looking at that?
Income taxes?
Well, that's not very big. It's gone up a bit.
Income taxes paid.
Income tax on the liabilities?
Yeah.
Ah, I hadn't noticed.
There, they owe IRS money.
Just a minute. Where? Income tax payable. You're right. Looks as if they haven't paid their taxes. A little bit disturbing. Something that I didn't notice until I read the cheat sheet, which is as to say the book that the authors provide to teachers with suggestions, is operating expenses. All right, the sales revenue hasn't changed that much, although they claim it's gone up, and yet their operating expenses are almost twice what they were the previous year.
Long-term note payable.
Something interesting there as well, actually, which we'll get to in a minute about the debts. Something which I also hadn't noticed but is interesting. Take a look at the cash flow for a minute. And you will also notice that for some reason, with all these things happened, they paid out five times the dividends they paid the year before. All right. So if you just looked at the summary measures, which presumably are what a accounting statement is probably designed to make good, you say that net income has increased. That increased return on assets and return on equity, isn't that wonderful? But why? Because of the extraordinary gain from the sale of land. Now, there may be some other, we're beginning to suspect that there are some other tricks as well, but at least that's big enough to switch it from a drop of about to about two-thirds of what it was to an increase to by about half. All right? Cash is way down. And inventory is way down. The two, as it were, solidest things in that sheet have vanished. And what's keeping up the value of assets is a jump in accounts receivable and unbilled accounts receivable, which are both at least somewhat dubious. Yes?
Why exactly would you have an unbilled accounts receivable?
That's a good question. I think the comment, again, on the cheat sheet I was looking is that ought to raise alarm flags on any accountant. And that they are, in fact, picking that up from a real case in which the executives involved went to jail. And in that case, the unbilled accounts receivable were trailers which they were building, which were sitting in on a lot that they belonged and which had not been sold. But there's one other thing which I hadn't thought about, but which is worth noting, and that's the interest payments. Let's go back. And if we look in the income statement, what happened to interest expense?
Increased.
Yeah, doubled roughly. What happened to the amount of the debt? Did it double? If you look at liabilities, short-term notes, long-term notes, short-term notes have gone down a bit, long-term notes have gone up a bit, total hasn't changed very much. So what does it mean if the total amount of the debt hasn't changed very much and the interest expense has doubled? What does that tell you?
They have an adjustable rate.
Well, they may have refinanced things, but it tells them that the interest rate they're actually paying has gotten much higher. Right? That in fact, for whatever reason, they are now paying roughly twice the interest rate they were paying the year before. Now, of course, you'd like to know more. Maybe interest rates in general have gone up. You know, this... interest rates do change from time to time, although doubling is pretty unusual over a year. But if interest rates in the general economy have not changed, what conclusion, what might you suspect when you observe that the interest rate they're paying has doubled? That they're seen as a very risky borrower and therefore have got to pay a substantially higher interest rate in order to compensate. So that's another possible alarm. All right. So I just ran through this. And the dividends are up. And that's also sort of curious. And I wouldn't have said that you normally see dividends up as a suspicious circumstance, but given everything else we've seen, how might you interpret that rise of dividends? What are the two obvious possibilities for a suspicious mind? If the company is really going bad, doing badly, if it's really being run into the ground or being looted in some way, why might it pay a large dividend? One answer is that the people who are doing the looting are stockholders. All right? If you suppose that a sizable fraction of the stock is held by the top executives, say 40% or something, if what they're actually planning to do is to default on their loans, if the actual plan is we're going to drive equity to a large negative number and then go bust, well, in order for us to get any gain out of that, we've got to transfer that money to us. It's true we're transferring some of it to the other stockholders as well, but nothing we can do about that. At least where every $2 we're stealing from the lenders, a dollar is going to our pockets. All right. So that would be one interpretation. What's the other interpretation? Suppose you happen to know that the people running the corporation don't own very much of the stock. What's the other reason they might be paying out a large dividend? Other than the SEC, who do they have to fool? The shareholders, right? In order for, if they're pulling off some kind of a scam, and the scam is going to end up with the company going bankrupt, then they want to keep the shareholders happy. And what's one way of keeping the shareholders happy? Say, look, we're doing just fine. Look at the size of the dividend we paid you this year. So all of those seem to me to be distinctly suspicious circumstances. That, I think, is the conclusion from this hypothetical case. That your client should not take the job. If he's feeling very public-spirited, he might try to see if he knows anybody at the SEC who would like a word of advice. If he's not feeling so public-spirited, he might see if he can sell the stock short. Far as I know, that would be perfectly legal, wouldn't it? He's not an insider. He hasn't taken a job with them. He's only relying on public information.
Well, it depends on if he owns a certain percentage.
Yeah, but yeah. No reason why he would. His first connection with them is they're offering him a job. So, anyway, that's my conclusion. And I think it's the conclusion that that particular problem was designed to lead you to, which is why I liked it. I think I told you I was once called up by somebody who identified himself as a forensic accountant. That was a great job description. All right, let's go on to a sort of quick once-over on what we spent the first half or whatever it is of the semester doing. And we've basically covered decision theory, game theory, moral hazard and adverse selection that got stuck into, I think, game theory for no good reason, contracting and accounting so far. And decision theory is basically a way of setting up a decision problem, which is designed to show you what information you need for the problem and how to use that information. So that in one sense, decision theory is all completely trivial. It all comes down to make the choice that gives you the best results. But by giving you a structure for doing it, I think since the world is often complicated, instead of saying, well, I should think about this and think about this, think about this, let's write down a tree diagram, let's put in the numbers, let's do the arithmetic. If we don't know the numbers, figure out what numbers we have to find out, stuff like that. So that's, I think, useful. Game theory is an intellectually much more interesting and exciting and difficult field, which has to do with trying to understand strategic behavior. I've just been thinking repeatedly, wondering if we can actually do anything useful out of the game theoretic problems of imperfect auction markets because of my World of Warcraft experience, where it is clear that there are some players who spend a lot of time in the World of Warcraft auction house and are in effect trying to cartelize particular sales and face a very interesting problem. Suppose that there is some cut gemstone in World of Warcraft that you can produce for 40 gold because you know how to cut it, and 40 gold is what the uncut stone sells. You would like to sell it for 80 gold. That would be a really great deal. And the reason you might be able to do it is it's a thin market, that there aren't very many players who spend their time doing this activity, so if you just put it up at 80 gold, with luck, nobody else will be putting one up, and maybe you'll get 80 gold. And then some no-good Nick comes in, and he puts his up for 70 gold. You now have two alternative strategies, both of which we observe. What are the things you might do if you want to sell your stones at 80 gold and you know you're more active than the other people putting stuff up and someone puts that up for 70? What might you do in response?
Second, 70 is reposted at 80.
First thing you might do is to buy out his 70 and repost it at 80, as you say, or just hold it because you've got yours up at 80. What's the risk in doing that? Well, that was the risk to begin with. You always have the risk that your price is too high, you don't buy. But suppose that you believe demand is not very elastic, that if people don't see an alternative, most of the ones who would buy at 40 would buy at 80. What about the other guy selling? What do I do?
More profitable for him, and then he starts selling more.
To take a real, this is not an imaginary example, except for the numbers, because I was, in fact, doing... I was the second guy. I was the no good nick in World of Warcraft. And when somebody buys your stone, it tells you who bought it. So I put up I observe that the person who is one of the dominant sellers is selling something at 50. I say that's too high a price. I put one up at 40. Very shortly it vanishes and I look and it was bought by that person. What do you think I do? I put up another at 40. All right. There's a limit, you know, she's not going to be able to resell 100 stones. She's going to be able to resell 5 or 6 stones. And if she buys 100, she goes bankrupt.
Yeah.
All right. So what's her alternative strategy?
She can
cut to 60.
Yeah.
And that way she doesn't do as well in terms of what the ones she sells, but at least her strategy is making it less profitable rather than more profitable for me. Of course, I can then cut to 50. None of us need this money to live on. It's all fake money anyway, and I find it sort of fun to know that I'm benefiting the rest of the world by holding prices down, which she may not have figured out yet. But you can see. But what I was thinking of was just, but now look at it from my standpoint for a moment. All right? Let's suppose I just want to make money, and I see her put the stone up at 80. Well, I say to myself, if I put one up at 78. She's not going to buy that out. She's going to cut to 76. If I put one up at 45, say my production cost is 40, she is going to say, well, look, buying him out for 45 is hardly more expensive than cutting the stone myself, and it takes it off the market. So I've got a complicated strategic problem of where in between her price and my production cost I ought to charge, because I would rather have her buy me out than cut below me. All right. I have a second problem, which is how many should I produce? Because if what I want to do is to maximize my revenue, I want to get her to follow the first strategy. So if when she starts buying me out, I just pour them in, well, it's going to work for a little while, but after that she'll start undercutting me. So it just struck me that there's a game theory problem, that this is sort of a real example where people are actually engaged in it, and it's true the stakes are rather lower than most real examples, but when you're playing a game, it feels real for, you know, within the game, which actually had moderately complicated kind of game theory strategic situation. Anyway, so game theory is about strategic behavior, where what I do, as in this example, depends on what I think she's doing, what she does depends on what she thinks I'm going to do. I'm trying to manipulate her, and she's trying to manipulate me, right? I want to manipulate her into buying me out instead of undercutting me. She wants to manipulate me into not undercutting her by very much.
Right? Why don't you cartel and sell it 100?
Yeah, that was the offer she made to my wife, the same person, I should say. My wife also plays the game, and like 6 months earlier, my wife was cutting gems at a lower level, actually, because it was earlier in the game. And the same person was engaged in the same game with her and basically said, look, either don't cut below our prices or we'll just drive you out of the market. And my wife, who had read the classic article on why predatory pricing doesn't work, basically said, if you want to sell 20 stones below cost every time I sell one, feel free. This is sort of a family issue, because the classic article was the result of an argument that my uncle came up with many, many years ago as to why the standard story on Standard Oil had to be wrong. And then another scholar we discussed it with actually did the research and found that Standard Oil never engaged in predatory pricing. It's just a myth. The article is called The Standard Oil Case, The Myth of Predatory Pricing by McGee. Good article. Anyway. The point I'm making is only that games are all around us, and some of them are even in games, as in World of Warcraft. So in game theory, we're looking at different sorts of games, different ways in which you can formalize games, and different senses of solution, which is not entirely clear. We then looked at moral hazard and adverse selection, the two problems commonly associated with insurance, but also with contracts in general. We then spent quite a lot of time on contracting, on maximizing the size of the pie, but getting incentives right, and then accounting. So if I go through these ones in more detail, and stop me if there's some point which is not clear to you. Decision theory does not provide the information you need to make a decision. That's from you. What it does is to let you graph out what choices are being made and the relation among those choices, and what unknown events, what random events, what die rolls are happening and their relationships, and the payoffs. So it doesn't give you the numbers, but it does tell you what numbers you have to get, because it says, look, here's this diagram. What number goes here? What number goes here? What number goes here? What's the payoff if you get to that point? What do you think the probability is that it'll go that way instead of that way? Stuff like that. Right. How do you do it? You set up a graph which shows the alternatives you can choose, which alternatives are chosen by chance and what their probabilities are, and what the outcomes and their payoffs are. That's basically what the graph consists of. How do you solve it? You start at the right end, you start at the last step, and you say, if we get to here, if we win our case, how much money do we get? If we lose our case, how much money do we get? If our employee basketball player turns out to have physical injuries and can't play, how much money do we get, and so forth. Each of the final outcomes, you put a number on. And if that outcome is following a decision by you, you say, well, look, that decision could lead to any of the following outcomes, which is the best one. That's what you'll do. Forget about the rest. If it's following a probabilistic event, you say, all right, getting to that probabilistic event gives you a 20% chance of this outcome, 30% of this, 50% of this. Add up probabilities times payoffs, and that gives you the average payoff for getting to this point. All right. So that's how you're reducing one layer of your graph. Now your whole graph is sort of one layer thinner. Repeat. Keep doing that till you end up with one point, which is at my starting point. I know now why I would do this, do this, do this, do this. If this random thing happens, I would do this, and my average payoff is such and such. All right. Continue until you know all decisions you will make. This you should be able to do. This is not rocket science. We've gone through it. It's pretty trivial. So if I give you a simple example and give you the information, you ought to be able to do that problem. And I might. I don't know. Did last time. How do you get the information to set up the problem? Not from decision theory, from your own expert knowledge. That's what you're getting paid by your client for. By your client's expert knowledge, because it's his problem after all. If you decide some piece of information is important and you don't have it, maybe you can do some research, such as look at past cases and see how many of them similar cases were won or lost, and by consulting with other experts. One of the things you want to think about is sensitivity analysis, to say which numbers are really important. If the only question is, should I make this choice because it makes me $1 million better off, or should I make it because it makes me $2 million better off, I don't care because it already tells me what choice to make. But if changing this number switches it from $1 million better off to $2 million worse off, then this number matters a whole lot. All right? For example, I think probably the clearest case where a small change could give a big swing is if you imagine the kind of litigation where there's a small probability of a very large award. You can easily imagine a case where if the probability of your losing the case and they're being awarded $50 million in punitive damages is 1%, you go to trial, and if it's 2%, you settle. And that's a small change, and knowing whether it's 1% or 2% would be hard. So far, I've put it all in terms of the sort of rational gambler who's just looking at his average payoff, probability times payoff, but if you are somebody for whom these payoffs are large compared to your assets, a 50% chance of winning $1 million may not compensate you for a 50% chance of losing $900,000. Right? So therefore, in those cases, you're going to have to put it not just in terms of expected return, but say, if I got to this point, what is the value to me of this lottery? Of a certain probability of this, certain probability of this, certain probability of this, that's equivalent to me of what certain sum. And that's a subjective question for your client, since he's the one who's audibly getting the payoffs. All right? Any questions on decision theory before I go on to my lightning summary of game theory? All of which has to be done before my voice goes out. Question? No. So, game theory, we considered bilateral monopoly bargaining. That's a very important, very common game that you'll spend some of your time in, I expect. And it's a nice, simple example of why game theory is hard, because it's sort of a trivial game. Here's an apple, worth a dollar to you, worth nothing to me, no one else exists. And yet there isn't a clear answer. And there isn't a clear answer because if you're going to hold out for 95 cents, if I'm going to hold out for 95 cents, you should pay it. And if you're going to hold out for only paying me 5 cents, I should accept it. All right. So that paradoxical nature gives you bluffs, threats, and commitment strategies. How can you represent a game? One way of doing it is to take advantage of our decision theory analysis and say, look, a sequential game, a game where I make a move, then you make a move, then I make a move, then you make a move, even with more than two people, you could graph that the same way we were graphing decision theory. Here is a box, and we'll color it red if I make the move, and blue if you make the move, and green if he makes the move. Each box has got lines out of it according to what you might decide to do. Each circle represents a die roll, and you could imagine graphing a game in that way. Make sense as a... But it does have to be a sequential game. I've got to know what you've done before I make my choice. And then you've got to know what I've done before you make your next choice. Whereas there are other games, such as the trivial scissors, paper, stone, which you can't graph that way because you're acting simultaneously. Any of you play bridge? What is your guess, if you were formally analyzing bridge, how many players there are in bridge?
How many players there are?
Yep.
It's two comments. So,
in a bridge, starting at the beginning.
From bidding, there's four players. So, I would say.
Nope, there are two players. They're rather odd players. Each of them has access to only part of his memory.
So you're assuming
that each partnership,
South and East and West are playing.
Each partnership have absolutely common interests. They score together. And therefore, it turns out that if you actually formally analyze bridge, you analyze it as a two-player game, but a rather odd two-player game in which people can forget things. In which, when I'm north, I know what cards north has, but not what cards south has. When I switch to being south, I forget what I knew about north, but learn what I knew about south, and so forth.
Yeah, it doesn't mean you play with a It's only for formal analysis. Some cards
yes.
are...
The one fundamental rule of bridge is trust your partner. My belief is that most of the great games, like bridge and chess, are successful partly because they're sort of a metaphor for real world situations and thus provide training for those situations. And what bridge is really about is coordination with imperfect communication, which is a real world problem of great importance. Anyway, you can represent it as something like a decision theory graph. That's what you do for subgame perfect equilibrium. And subgame perfect equilibrium works just like decision theory, except there's more than one person. You go to the far end at the last decision anybody makes, and you say, I know what decision he's going to make, because I've got the payoffs there, and he makes whichever decision gives him the highest payoff. Lop off all his other alternatives. Since we know what he's going to do, we know what the previous step stage will lead to, because when we get to him, he's determined. Run that all the way back, just like decision theory, and sure enough, we have an answer. So that's why it's such an attractive system. But as I argued, it has real limits in the real world, not only because games aren't all sequential, but because of commitment strategies, because of the fact that it might be that you're arguing that it might be that if you do X, I'll do Y. Y hurts you. It hurts me too. All right? But that's all right. The fact that I'm going to do Y means you won't do X, and I don't want you to do X. That's the guts of a equipment strategy. That's the kid throwing a tantrum. So you ought to be able to do the simple subgame perfect equilibrium, and you ought to understand what its limits are. That's about as far as I think you can reasonably go. Questions on subgame perfect equilibrium. A much more general way of looking at games, and the way von Neumann uses, is a strategy matrix. And a strategy matrix just says, imagine a two-player game, because we usually do the stuff on paper, and paper has only got two dimensions. So for a two-player game, we say, all right, my strategy is a full description of how I'm going to play. And that would be very long for a real game. For a really simple game like scissors, paper, stone, it's pretty simple. Along one side of your grid, you have player one strategies. Along the other side, you have player two strategies. Each cell shows the payoff to the two players. If I play this strategy and you play that strategy. So if you're doing it formally, mathematically, that gives you a way in which you can describe all games, which is sort of neat. It turns out that with such a matrix, there are at least two interesting solution concepts. One of them is really convincing, but almost never happens. And that's a dominant pair of strategies, a dominant solution. But a dominant one, what I mean here is, whatever you do, this is the right thing for me to do. Whether you keep your mouth shut or betray me, betraying you is the right thing for me to do. Whether I keep my mouth shut or betray you, betraying me is the right thing for you to do. We know what you're going to do, we go home. All right. That, again, assumes away commitment strategy and lots of other stuff, but it does mean that for a game that's like that, we have a pretty clear answer. And again, you should be able to recognize, if I show you a matrix, I probably won't, but if I did show you a matrix with a dominant solution like Prisoner's Dilemma, you should be able to spot it.
Can you apply the strategy matrix in all of the game solutions?
In all what?
In all, like in the game theory section, you went through several solution concepts.
I think you can, in principle, you could describe all games by a strategy matrix. The problem is solutions. And the only place I know of where the strategy matrix is actually useful for solutions is the two-player fixed subgame. Because for that, von Neumann has a definition of a solution which at least has a family resemblance to what a solution ought to be. If you think about it, what is a solution? Solution is a way of playing such that it gets me a certain amount, and not only can I not get any more than that for sure, you can guarantee I don't get any more than that if you play perfectly too. All right, so that sounds, you know, it's fuzzy, but I think it's as close as you're going to get.
Okay. So it can still be applied in the other solution concepts, but
You could still have a matrix for a non-fixed sum game perfectly easily.
Okay, you just might not necessarily get.
For example, Prisoner's Dilemma is not a fixed sum game.
Okay.
And yet you can draw the strategy matrix. In that case, there's a dominant solution, so that's easy too.
Okay.
But I don't think I don't know of any useful way of using a strategy matrix to find something that you would call a solution, even for all two-player games, let alone multiplayer games. What's attractive about it is just is a way you could represent any such game. And that's sort of a first step if you're trying to think of, if you're thinking like a mathematician, what you want to do is to not to solve this special case. What you want to do is to somehow have a general case that covers a whole wide range of things and analyze that. All right, it's a very powerful tool when you can get away with it. Right? If you think about Newtonian mechanics, that is the general case of all billiard balls, all planets, all things moving under Newtonian forces, as long as they're not going fast enough to be relativistic to matter.
Or very small dimensions,
yeah. But basically, it's a case where sort of, you know, a page of mathematics covers enormous chunks of the universe. So it's a very powerful tool when you can do it. So, von Neumann solution, there's no reason you should know how to find a von Neumann solution. I haven't told you how to find one, though I've shown you one for scissors, paper, stone, but it's nice if you at least know what the idea is. Other solution concepts we've looked at, Nash equilibrium is, in a way, has some of the same problems as subgame perfect equilibrium, namely it's assuming away a whole bunch of things that might happen. In particular, it's assuming away any coordination among the players, and it's at least fudging on how my changing what I do changes what you do. That somehow we've got to define your strategy in a way which includes your response to everything I do, which is why, as I pointed out, in oligopoly theory, you can get quite different answers according to whether you think a strategy is setting a price or setting a quantity to produce. So the simple example, which everybody always remembers, of Nash equilibrium is everyone driving on the right side of the road. And that has two interesting features. One of them is that there are two equilibria. Everyone driving on the left side of the road is also in equilibrium. And the other is that with coordinated, the second one is that one of the equilibria is better than the other, given what the rest of the world is doing, and that you could imagine coordinated activity switching from one to the other, as Sweden actually did. An example that I like in some ways better, though it's less obvious, it's more dramatic, and that's my escapees from death row, where the Nash equilibrium is that you all go back into your cells, or at least you stand there and don't rush our governor with his gun with one bullet in it. And that's a Nash equilibrium, because if everybody does that, anyone who doesn't do it dies and is therefore better off doing it too. All right? And that's a nice case because from the standpoint of the people who are doing it, it's such a perverse Nash equilibrium. It's as bad as a prisoner's dilemma, in fact. Because if any two of them rush him, they're better off. And if they all rush him, they're much better off. All right? Any questions on Nash equilibrium? Again, an idea you should understand, and I might ask you to explain it. Might not. Shelling points are another idea that I find sort of interesting and that seems to have some explanatory power for people's behavior, and that's the idea of converging on what are seen as unique outcomes, like a 50-50 split. And the ultimate argument for doing that, I think, is that you see the alternatives as agree to this or someone of this smear of possibilities, and this smear of possibilities results in further bargaining, and that's costly. All right? And one of the relevant points about Schelling points is that they are really a subjective fact, not an objective fact. That is to say, what is unique depends on how your mind organizes stuff. Does that make sense to you or not? My standard example is put up a bunch of numbers on the board, and the question is, which of these numbers is unique?
And so, suppose the numbers are 2, 4, 10, 2, 3, 4, 7, 10, 12, 16, 69. Now let's just stop there. That's about enough for my purposes. The question is, which of these numbers is unique? Well, I think a lot of people in our society who are not mathematicians would say, well, 10 is unique, obviously. I mean, you know, 10, 100, 1,000, it's a number which is just, you know, the simplest kind of number in our system. You didn't have one on that. On the other hand, the mathematician would say, well, 10 is no different than any other number. I mean, you could have a base 3 system, math system just as easily. We've got 16 and 4 are both squares, so we've got 2 perfect squares, so that's not unique. 7 and 3 are both primes. We've got. That's right. But what is 2? It is the world's only even prime. So the mathematician, it seems to me, could very easily say 2 is the unique one. How about someone who's illiterate? Someone who does not, in fact, know what those symbols mean. Which of those looks like the most distinct of those here? Got it. Upside down is the same number. You can think of other reasons you might think of that as unique. But my point is only that the uniqueness itself is a statement about how the mind classifies the information, not a statement about the facts of the real world. And that's a point which often isn't made, but it seems to me is interesting. And one reason it's interesting is that one of the tactics you can imagine engaging in bargaining, if you think Schelling points are going to affect the outcome, is affecting how the problem is being classified. Are we having a 50-50 split of revenue or of profit? Is it an even split between families or between people? Is it an even split between nations on an absolute or a per capita basis? I mean, you can think of a lot of different ways, and I suspect, though I don't know that people do this, in which you could try to manipulate bargaining by the way you present the problem, if you think Schelling points are going to matter. All right? Any questions so far? This is very much a sort of superficial discussion, but then we've had the long discussion before. Moral hazard is an obvious problem, that if part of the cost of the factory burning down is paid by the insurer, then I will only take those precautions whose benefit is enough larger than the cost, so they my share of the benefit pays for all of the cost. All right? And that results in some worthwhile precautions not being taken, which is a bad thing in the sense that I and the insurance company together would be better off if those precautions were taken. One solution is for the insurance company to require certain precautions.
it may occur to you that the basic way of thinking here is very much like what we were doing in going to be doing in contracts in a minute, namely thinking of how you get people to have an incentive to make the decisions that maximize the joint gains to the people involved. Right? Another is to have only partial insurance so that I will take all of the really good precautions, even though not the precautions that only pay off a little better than their cost. And in some cases, moral hazard is a feature, not a bug, because it might be that the insurance company is better than I am at keeping the factory from burning down. Okay. Adverse selection is the market for lemons problem. The fact that with used cars or people buying insurance or lots of other things, one of the parties has information the other doesn't have, and the same act that's an attempt to make a transaction is also a signal. So as the seller accepting your offer of my car signals that it's probably a lemon, which is the reason for you to give me a low offer, and if you're giving me a low offer, then my accepting is a really strong signal that it's probably a lemon. Maybe it's a cream puff and I'm really fed up with it for some reason, but those aren't the odds. One solution is for the seller to guarantee the used car, which gets you back to moral hazard problems. Discuss the genetic testing. There was a neat bit by Brian Kaplan, who's an economist I know, on a blog, to which I don't think he had a really good solution, which is, why doesn't adverse selection destroy the adultery market? That after all, the fact that a guy is willing to have an affair with you when he's married and at least tell you that he's willing to abandon his wife and marry you should signal the fact that he's not the kind of guy you want to be married to. So maybe the answer is it does, and maybe there'd be even more adultery than there were if that problem didn't exist. I'm not sure. Or alternatively, the adultery involves people neither of whom really plans to marry the other one. But I thought it was a good point, so I thought I'd pass it on to you. So, contracting, which was basically an application of economics, whether or not it said so. And the basic idea is, how do you maximize the total gain from a contract? We can't tell you how to maximize the share of the pie you get. That's a bargaining problem. And the basic answer is that you give the players, the people who are making decisions, the right incentives. As best you can, you arrange so that if something costs $10,000 and produces a combined benefit for the parties, it's more than that, it's done. If less than that, it isn't. And there are lots of possible somethings that it might be, up to and including breaching the contract. And costs, of course, aren't all in money. They can all be thought of as in money, and you can say how much would I have to be paid to spend this amount of time, take this risk, or whatever. We went into some detail on construction contracts. Fixed price contract has the virtue of giving you an incentive to minimize cost, giving the person you've contracted with, the builder, but it also gives them an incentive to reduce cost by skimping on quality. A cost plus, he has no incentive to either minimize cost or skimp on quality. A cost plus a percentage of the cost might make sense if you believe that unmeasured costs scale with measured costs, but it also gives them an incentive to increase costs and to build only gold-plated Cadillacs. How do you choose among different contracts? You basically ask, of the problems the different contracts imply, which are the hardest ones to control, and if there is a risk, who can best bear it? How do you try to limit the damage which will always be done by the fact that you can never get a perfect solution to these problems? You think about the fact that what you can specify depends both on knowledge. It doesn't do any good to require him to use high-quality materials if you can't tell whether materials are high-quality. And also what you can observe. It doesn't do any good for you to require him to use high-quality materials for a part of the construction that nobody's ever going to see because it's in between two layers of concrete. Other sorts of contracts get discussed. Principal agent, joint undertaking, sale or lease of property and loan. And one further option for a form of the contract is paying by results. So that instead of either saying, I'll pay you a fixed sum or I'll pay you whatever it costs, I'll say, I will pay you if you win the case and I won't pay you if you don't. I'll pay you if you sell somebody that car, I won't pay you if you don't, and so forth. Accounting. There are basically four things about mechanics that you're supposed to understand: a balance sheet, a cash flow statement, an income statement, and T accounts. Any questions about any of those four? We've just been doing them at some length, and I feel as though I understand them much better than I did 3 years ago before I started teaching this course. And the relation among them. And the T accounts are for individual transactions. Each transaction shows up twice, once on the left side of a T account, once on the right side of a T account, either because a gain balances a loss, or because a gain without a loss increases income and eventually increases equity. And what does a loss without a gain do? Answer obvious. Just trying to rest my voice for a moment. What does a loss without a gain do? It lowers equity and lowers income. Lowers income and eventually lowers equity, right? Perfectly symmetrical. The fundamental equation is that assets equal liabilities plus equity, alias equity is assets minus liabilities. In order for that to stay true when something happens, either liabilities don't change, for example, we turn one liability into another, assets don't change, we reduce cash, increase oil in our tanks, change in assets equal change in liabilities, or a change in assets or liability shows up in equity, or some combination of those. Those are all the possibilities, and they all involve two things. The complications in accounting, one of them is what time period you allocate income and expenses to, and the basic idea is to try to, as best you can, group income and associated expenses and try to put them in the time when the thing when you do the things that they're associated with. Not always simple. We discussed at least one case where you could imagine doing it in either of 2 years on different bases. And the fact that in order to get it to a system that isn't all judgment calls, you have to do a whole lot of simplification. And that includes using the purchase price for the value of things, ignoring intangibles unless they have a purchase price, treating uncertain outcomes as either zero or certain. I was wondering if anybody did sort of accounting on accounting firms. And when I'm thinking about who tells the firm how likely it is that you're going to win, that you're going to lose a lawsuit? Is it the house attorney who tells them that? Somebody else? Because it would be really interesting if you had some organization that was routinely saying this is more or less like 50% and you could actually keep score and see if they were right. How do you use accounting information? Depends who you are. What a lender wants to know is if you'll be paid back. Supplier wants to know if he'll be paid in the short run. An employee wants to know the future of the company. An investor wants to know the long-term expectations of the firm. To know if the firm can meet its short-term obligations, you want to look at short-term assets and liabilities. To know if it's solvent in the long term, you want to look at assets to liabilities, or if you like, liabilities to equity. Same information. How well run is the firm? You can look at the things I've got there. How profitable is the firm? How you can be misled by accounting information? We've just had fun running through that in a somewhat cooked up case designed to be discovered, I think. Book value might understate land bought long ago, might overstate the brand name value for the leading buggy whip manufacturer. Some assets may exist only on the books, accounts receivable that won't be paid, prepayment of expenses that won't produce income. Going back, by the way, to the final accounting case we looked at, the one thing I didn't mention and should have was that large rise in operating expenses. What might that operating expense have been? Now that we've gotten suspicious about that company, where do you think that extra $1 million or whatever it was going?
Executive pay.
Good guess. Right? Executive pay or some other way of funneling money to the whoever is in the scheme. Right? That seems plausible. All right. And, of course, a single year's results might be due to special circumstances, which might or might not be relevant to future years. So I think that's it, and I've got 2 minutes to go. So if you have any questions in the last 2 minutes, feel free to ask them. I think my voice is good for at least 3 minutes. and I go home to bed.
Between the major subjects, are they each
weighted
the same on the exam?
Oh, boy. Figure, I'll try to weight them by how much time we spend on them. That if I had to guess, decision theory is less important than accounting, say. And certainly that's interesting, game theory. But it also gets, the thing is, there's only room for like, you know, five questions or so given the time, depending on how long the questions are, but that's sort of roughly what I'd be aiming at.
Okay.
So I can't do a very fine adjustment, and partly it's going to be what can I think of doing questions on. And then I can make some attempt in the final to sort of adjust that a little further. If I ended up with no questions at all on a decision theory in the midterm, that would be a pretty good signal that I try to squeeze one in on the final, for example. All right. Go home. Don't get too close to me.